The Local Thread. And once again, hello and welcome to The Anderson Hour, part of FM 91's The Local Thread, and streaming on WGTE.org. My name is Jerry Anderson. I mentioned last week on our first program a bit about my background growing up here in South Toledo and wanting to be a broadcaster from, well, way back in junior high school days. And then during nearly four decades of television journalism in Toledo, it turns out that many of my favorite broadcasts were on shows like this one. I mean, I'm thinking of Toledo Up Front when I was over at Channel 13. Leading Edge on WTOL. Overlapping some of those years, Anderson and Company. The Morning Show for several years on WSPD. You see, on these programs, I got to dig a little deeper than the standard TV newscast story into issues I cared about, which I believed our audience cared about. And I'm so thrilled that WGTE FM 91 has asked me to continue those discussions right here. I often return to issues involving education. It's just too important not to. Give a kid raised in the worst circumstances a good education, and he can get out. In our system, in our state, you don't have to pay, at least not tuition, to get a good K-12 education. It says so right in the state constitution. But that's the same constitution that Ohio's highest court has said repeatedly Ohio lawmakers have violated in their treatment and funding of Ohio public education. See why I get fired up? We're going to start this Anderson Hour with someone who knows the issues well, very well. He's lived them as a professional educator for decades, a school superintendent for the past quarter century. Last year, the longtime superintendent of Parrysburg's public schools surprised me, and I'm guessing others, by announcing he was leaving the district to become the CEO of the Ohio School Boards Association. And we're going to start this Anderson Hour with someone who knows the issues very, very well. He's lived them as a professional educator for decades, a school superintendent for the past quarter of a century. Last year, the longtime superintendent of Parrysburg's public schools surprised me, and I'm guessing others, by announcing he was leaving the district to become the CEO of the Ohio School Boards Association. And I welcome in Mr. Tom Hosler, Mr. Superintendent. I think the title stays with you, like president, governor, and stuff.
I'm not sure about that, but thanks. Thank you.
All right. And it's good to have you along. And I do want to thank you for working tirelessly. Even before a superintendent, he was in the classroom. He was an administrator. He's a lifelong educator. And I think it puts you in the perfect position to ask, to answer some of the questions that I want to ask you about. Let's start with, what was the attraction to the Ohio School Boards Association leadership post?
Sure. So superintendent for 25 years in Parrysburg for 18. There was only one position that I applied for during my entire time at Parrysburg, and that was for the state superintendent's position. So I was a finalist for that position, and what led me to apply for that, and I was a finalist for that position, was very similar to what attracted me to the Ohio School Board Association, which is really being able to bring to the table what is happening in the classroom, what's happening in the local school, districts, and being outside of that Columbus belt, like so many people in Ohio are. Right. But having that ability to bring that perspective, I think over the years I've been able to pull people together to focus on the right things, and it seemed like a great opportunity to do that, to work with over 700 school boards in Ohio, their school board members, and help support them in a variety of ways. That excited me, so I threw my hat in the ring and. Here I am. So.
In my notes, and yes, I had written right here, over 700 school boards, and I jokingly told somebody, well, my friend Tom went from running one school district to now running over 700 of them. But to be clear here, yeah. You're not telling those boards what to do as much as you are, I think, helping them do what they need to do and also do that effectively. Am I close there?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we want to be the first call that school boards make when they want to get better. We are often the first call they make when things are challenging and things are difficult. And but it's providing that here are the best practices and here are the things that you can do together as a school board to make a difference for the students in your community. And I'm not in charge. It's kind of like being a, and I use a lot of analogies, and not all of them are great, so I'll warn you now. But you think about those seven, they're all like individual ships that are out on the lake.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in Point Place,
I know you did.
and seeing the big lake ships come in, it used to be a lot of fun to be, we'd ride our bikes to the shore and see the waves crash. But there's 700 ships that are out there, with precious cargo. And it's our job to be kind of that lighthouse that shows them the way to get to where they want to go safely, and the best way to get there. And really, that drives what we do. You know, we want to be the most respected voice when it comes to public education. And public education, as you know, and you've covered a lot of great stories, and but there's sometimes that lack of people coming together. You have the urbans and the rurals, and everyone's doing their own thing. At OSBA, we have that ability to bring everyone together for that one focus. And that's really where we have been spending our time.
Let's talk about Perrysburg for a moment, because I think Perrysburg is just a wonderful case study. I've watched it for years. I'm from here, after all. So you start with the important stuff, and that is teaching kids. Student performance results, as measured by state standards, have been at the top of, if not off the charts, for years in Perrysburg. My Auto Hills friends are saying, "Hey, what about us?" Okay, they're right up there, but so is Perrysburg, right? Which is a much larger system. And here's the catch 22, as I've observed this, Tom Hosler. The community's impressive growth is, in my mind, I don't think there's any doubt, is tied directly to that school district performance. Families want to have their kids in good school districts, and nobody can make me believe otherwise. But with all those families come those kids who need teachers, who need places to attend and to learn. That's more buildings, that's more employees, that's more cost. That phrase, victims of their own success, comes to mind. Did it ever feel like that?
I think there were times where you could kind of feel that, where people felt like it's the chicken or the egg. If the community is growing, so we need more teachers and we need more staff and the funds that go with that. And then there were some that were saying, well, if we stop providing the funds for those things, will that slow down the growth? And so there was conversations like that. And I know with bond issue, the most recent bond issue, there was an interview that WTOL did of a resident at a park, and that's exactly what she said. And so I think there's an element of that for sure. But sometimes there has to be a reset in the community where people, have to come to terms with, what is it that we want for our community? And what is it that we want for our students? And you see that cycle happen in communities. And I think Perrysburg, my last months there, we did pass a levy in May. We had 75% approval on that levy,
It was big,
and
yeah.
which was the highest level of approval. You'd have to go back to 1960 to do that. So in May, before I left, I think the train was on the track, and then certainly what they did this fall with their operational levy, a huge lift by the team there, and the community rallied, and I think you had 66% of the community support that. So I think that question has been discussed and answered.
Let's get into because I think we'll learn something from this. A lot of folks will say, okay, all those expensive homes, man, nice homes popping up like mushrooms in Perrysburg. Let's apply the latest millage, okay, to those high-priced homes. And remember, folks, the largest portions of our real estate taxes goes to where? Education, to schools. Seems like this should be a windfall. All right, to schools. Unless the other part of the funding equation is not keeping up, and I'm talking about state funding. Did it keep up?
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that. I think there's two parts to that to the answer. One of them is a structural change that occurred back in 1976. And then the other part, I'll bring it back to where we are with the state formula. But in 1976, you had some very similar conditions to what we're seeing now, which was something called stagflation. So wages were stagnant, inflation was growing rapidly in the 70s, and at that time, if the school district, and I'll use very simple terms here, and I'm going to be just kind of general so people can kind of follow along, but if you passed a 4 mill levy in 1974, and that 4 mill levy brought in $4 million, and let's say a new subdivision goes in, let's say a Ford plant opened up in your community, so that next year, the school district collected 4 mills, the same. And now, instead of getting $4 million, they're getting $4.5 million because now you've added all these homes and businesses. So people were saying, wait a minute, I'm being taxed out of my home. So the legislature said, we need to have a circuit breaker back in 1976, and it was called House Bill 920. And what the circuit breaker did was this. So for levies after 1976, if you pass a 4 mill levy, same breakdown. 4 mill levy, it generates $4 million, and a new Ford plant goes in, a new kind of a subdivision goes in. That next year, the school district can only collect $4 million, and now the 4 mills drops down to 3.7 or 3.75.
A levy for schools could never generate more money for the schools than it did on the date it was approved or when it was enacted.
Correct. There, so I'm gonna give an asterisk because then you get into inside mills and outside mills. So the inside mills, school districts, so county commissioners in the 88 counties of Ohio can allocate a certain number of mills for schools. It's usually around 5 mills that can grow. But we're talking about 70 voted mills or 40 voted mills. So it's a pretty small amount, but you're correct in that. So what's happened, Jerry, since 1976, there have been over 11,000 school levies in Ohio, not just Perrysburg, because I know people in Perrysburg think there's been 11,000 levies in Perrysburg, but across Ohio. And there isn't another state that does that. And it's because of that circuit breaker, because you can't get that kind of growth. And the only way that you can get it is going to your local community to ask for more. So that is not a it's not in it's not a Perrysburg thing, it's not a Washington local thing. It is a statewide thing that there's been that many levies. Now, we have the fair school funding formula, the fair school funding plan that was adopted. We began work about 7 years over 7 years ago on this, which is a delicate balance between the local share and the state share. And the local share is based on, two factors. One is your community's income, the residents, and the other part is the property valuation. So what is the property value worth in your community? Because those two things impact what the state share is. And the state share was driven by the average teacher salary, the average principal salary, all these averages. So the way it should work is as the local community's valuations increase every year, the state should be updating their averages of what they're contributing to that delicate balance. And what happened this past year is the state did not update those numbers. And so as a result, the local share communities in the eyes of the state are getting wealthier because the home values are increasing across the state. And then at the same time, the state is saying, well, the numbers that we're coming to the table with are old. They're not updated. And that's what you're hearing from a lot of districts and school boards right now, is that they needed to update that. That would have helped out a lot of districts. The average state share right now is a little over 40%. That so for every dollar that comes into a school district, the state is providing about 40, a little over 40, 45 cents of that dollar. In the next 3 years, that number will drop to about 37 cents.
Wow. And
And
you
where
know
does the rest come from? It comes from the residents.
And when that percentage drops, you know who has to deal with it? The members of over 700 boards of education around the state of Ohio. And I'm going to jump back into that as we get back on course here with the CEO. Now, that's been interesting stuff, but it sets the stage for where we're going as we talk about school boards. Who are those people? My guest is the CEO of the Ohio School Boards Association. He's Tom Hosler. And we're going to be back with more of the Anderson Hour right after this. This is the Anderson Hour. I'm Jerry Anderson. He is Tom Hosler. He is the CEO of the Ohio School Boards Association. If you remember him from Perrysburg, I want to say 18 years as the super there. And before that, 7 years, Huron.
Yes, in Michigan.
Let's
Yes.
get back to school boards, if I could. These are folks, I mean, they live among us. We see them at the Kroger. We may be socializing with them. We may go to school with them. They don't have to have formal education in running schools or balancing budgets. But man, society and American politics put a bunch of our problems squarely at their feet. Who are these people and what makes them tick?
I think being on the school board is, typically you see people who are very committed to their communities. They're very committed to, making a difference in the lives of the students in their communities. And, they want to be leaders and do the right thing for not only the students and the staff, but also their community members. And, in a lot of ways, it is the purest form of democracy. So let's think about that. There are no, special boundaries that board members, this is your area.
They
This
can't
is,
gerrymander their jobs.
yeah. So this is, the entire, they represent the entire school district. They are, people who you can, as you pointed out, you can find them under the Friday Night Lights. You can find them in aisle 13 of the grocery store. And you can go to a board meeting that when it's going to take place. You can sign up for public comments, and you can address them, and you can demand accountability. And you don't see that as much as you used to. And public education, school boards are that last form of democracy, and they are really there on that front line. And so it is crucial. I had somebody tell me that really school boards are the canary in the coal mine. If you want to know how healthy the democracy is across the state, take a look at what's happening with school boards.
Well, let's get
And
into that because I believe every school board member I've ever known has stories about the angry 1 a.m. phone calls from parents or uncomfortable encounters at a community or social event, again involving parents. We seem to be, and now we are, getting less civil as a society, it seems to me. And fears for board members, are fears for board members unfounded, or are they something we have to be aware of and take seriously as a possibility?
Yeah, I don't know if fear is the right word. I think that service on the school board should be something that is celebrated. It shouldn't be seen as I did my time or a tour. And I think it's with social media and the attention, and schools are the cause of and the cure to all of communities' problems. And I think board members feel that. They feel that pressure, that weight. And I think what they are people who are raising their hand, I will step forward, I will serve. And then how do I deal with the social media and people who I've never met who are saying these things about me? And I think that is a challenge. And I don't know if it's a fear per se, as much as it is that reality of, people are attacking me and they never met me, and here's who I am, and that's a challenge.
Yeah. Let's make a list. I wrote down a little list here. It probably won't even be close to yours because you're the guy in charge. Make a list when you talk to your school boards around the state of the biggest problems facing school boards, which I would suggest are the biggest problems facing public education. By categories, give me some of the top ones that you're hearing about already.
Yeah, I think, having stable funding that school boards can work with their staff and they can project out, this is what we need in the future, and to be able to explain it to community. So I think that's number one. Number two is, we have significant challenges with the students that we serve. We have in Ohio a number of students, almost 50% that are eligible for free and reduced lunch. And how are we meeting students' needs? And it's becoming more complex as to what those needs are. When you and I went to school, compared to where things are today, the society has changed in many ways, and how do schools change with that? So I think there's a area of meeting the needs of the students that we serve. It all comes back to families, and how have families changed, since the time that we were in school. And how do we adapt to that? I think school boards are worried about people who want to get into the profession. I can tell you firsthand, when I started at Perrysburg, if we had a teaching opening in any subject matter, the list of applicants was long. We could cherry pick the best of the best. Today, I think the last year when we had openings for high school English or math, single digit applicants. And we were in a position where we have two great universities, public universities, private universities. So I think the staffing, who is going to step up and work in public education, given the fear, because a lot of the policies and the social issues, I like to say, Jerry, that public education has become a football, and there's two teams on the field competing. And they're passing the ball, they're dropping the ball, they're fumbling it, they're punting it. And that takes a toll not only on school board members, but certainly on those that want to serve. Because why, I can go work somewhere else and do something and not worry about Facebook or being accused of things. And so I'm worried about that. I think board members worry about that as well. And then who will raise their hand to serve on school boards? Because your family, if you're a business owner, you're working for a company, that you have to really think about if something controversial comes up, which inevitably they will.
It will.
That how could this impact my family, my kids, my business, and who is willing to serve? And that's a huge worry too.
Ohio's voucher system was designed, if you want to go back to its roots, on a very small scale to help kids and families in failing schools to get out to have an escape route to a better source of education. It didn't start district-wide, it started with a school. A troubled school in Cleveland. It's become something very different. Families with six-figure incomes are now taking public vouchers and funding the cost of private schools. How out of balance do you think the voucher system is given public education's funding challenges that we've talked about?
I think you've seen, people from both caucuses begin to say, let's set aside should vouchers be here or not. And I know that's going to be litigated, in the courts here. But let's set that aside for a moment. You have public tax dollars to the tune of over, $1 billion that are going for this program. How can we account for those funds in a way that and I know where our tax dollars are going? And so you're seeing people from both caucuses beginning to say, we're hearing from people who are asking this question. So I think that is one place to start, and that is if vouchers are here and there's not going to be a change anytime soon, how can we make sure that those funds are being accounted for in a way that we've come to expect from the state? And I think secondly too, with that, for parents to make informed decisions, if we look at the state report card and, all the different kind of accountability measures that come with those dollars for public schools, how can we ensure that parents are able to make informed decisions about applying, or looking at those? And if it's so important that 1.6 million students are being asked to take these tests and be subject to those standards, I think we're hearing from people saying it should apply all the way across the board because those are state dollars.
And it doesn't right now.
No, that's correct. So, we certainly respect, we want and respect what parents feel is best for their children. Where it starts to lose is now that you've attached those public dollars to it, how can we account for those dollars and where it needs to go? Makes it a challenge here.
Maybe I should have rolled this in earlier when we were talking about school funding, but I have it on my list here because it's a forward-looking thing. We were talking about real estate taxes earlier. You know, there are people in Columbus where you now work. So look out, look over your shoulder, who are saying, all right, we're doing away with real estate taxes. We're doing away with property taxes. Well, good Lord. Somebody explain to me how we're going to fund schools and everything else that is currently funded. Where's the Ohio School Board Association on that one?
So, my brother's a firefighter, and we were talking about this just recently. And their message is, if this amendment to abolish all property taxes goes through, if you're shoveling snow in the driveway and you have a heart attack and someone calls 911, we're not coming. That's pretty simple for them, because they don't have the funds to operate the trucks and all the kind, because it's all property taxes. For schools, we're required to do certain things, to educate students, to provide this much time. But what would happen is you would see abbreviated days. You would see school districts close because they don't have the funds to operate. Think about some districts in Ohio are receiving, 70% of their funding from the state. They wouldn't be able to open. So the economic impact that this would have on businesses would be staggering, because parents are saying, I can't, my school's not open, or they're shutting down at noon every day because that's the minimum. That's what they have to do. I have to leave work. I can't come into work because I need to be here for my children. That's going to play out across the state of Ohio. And what about the communities where that local school is the largest employer in that community? And the impact that that will have on that community, you can't undo that. The people who are advocating for this, if you listen to them carefully, are saying things like, it's not our job to come up with the solution. It's the legislature's job. So you're gonna blow it up, not knowing what the answer is going to be.
Yeah, our job
That's
isn't
scary.
to come up with a solution, but what we will make our job is to create the problem that will
Right,
need a
right,
solution. All right, we're going to
right.
leave it right there for time. He is Tom Hosler. He is the CEO, Ohio School Boards Association. Thank you for spending time with us. And again, very sincerely, thanks for a career that you have spent in many years to come in the field of education.
Well, thank you, Jerry, and thank you for this opportunity. It's great to hear your voice, and you've been a great friend, not only for public education, but to so many other, great programs across Northwest Ohio.
I've
It's
been
great
honored
to hear you
to be
back out
involved.
there. So,
All right. When we come back, that Toledo attorney who's written a book about 50 years of trial law in Lucas County. This is the Anderson Hour. In a career covering the news, more than a few of our stories involved court cases, and America loves courtroom dramas. From the Perry Mason of my youth to the Law and Orders and Boston Legals of network drama fame to the myriad real-life Court TV and Nancy Grace TV offerings, we're drawn to the drama that plays out in our nation's courtrooms. Now, make no mistake, most courtroom trials don't have the drama of TV's best, but it is where you will likely be adjudicated or charged with a crime. It's also where we rely on the system to mete out justice if we're the victims of crime. I'm joined by longtime Toledo trial lawyer and now author Lauren Zaner. He recounts his half century of trial experiences in his book, The Making of Darth Zaner. All right, that title certainly gets my attention and demands an explanation, but I'll get to that soon enough. I'm joined by longtime Toledo trial lawyer and now author. Here's his book. I know for those of you on radio, you can't see it, but the streaming folks, you see The Making of Darth Vader. Now that title gets attention and demands an explanation, and I'll get to that soon enough, okay? Give me some time here. Mr. Zaner, good to see you and welcome.
Great to see you, Jerry. It's been a while since we've had time to spend some time together.
No doubt. In terms of introduction and background here, you're a native Toledoan, raised in the Old West End. I love that neighborhood. But you say you didn't really come from a family of wealth. And just in terms of background, as I read about you, it seems from the very earliest days, you were, sir, a worker. You'd find a job here, do something there, anything to make a buck. And I bring that up early here because that to me, as a young person, showed ambition. And as I read the rest of your book, I think that really fuels your journey into the practice of law. Am I right? Am I making that connection, or am I reaching a little bit there?
No, Jerry, you're absolutely correct. Growing up, our family was always struggling to make ends meet, never had a lot of money. And so from an early age, I started doing anything to make a buck, cutting lawns, raking leaves, selling magazines door to door. I was a bag boy at Kroger's and worked in factories and anything to make a dollar. I've always worked hard. My family always brought up that education was very important, so I always worked hard to try to get good grades.
Okay, I was bag boy at Food Town, by the way, Seaway Food Town in Bowling Green. So we have that in common. I'm going to jump ahead. Speaking of education, this guy then trots off just down the street to the University of Toledo. And like most lawyers to be, graduates with a degree in chemical engineering and graduates with honors. Now, that's impressive. To me, it sounds like that's the first step to a lucrative career in engineering. It doesn't, however, sound like the most likely avenue to law school in a career in our area's courtroom. What led you from chemical engineering to law?
Well, Jerry, I started working at Owens Corning Fiberglass my senior year in college. Dr. Gary Bennett from my chemical engineering class was able to get me a spot there. And after about 6 months, they had a purge where they just got rid of a bunch of engineers just because they could. So I saw that potentially in my future, and I said I need to look at and consider something else possibly. So I was thinking about either a law degree or a PhD or a business degree, and law seemed to make the most sense. I mean, I worked at Owens Corning my senior year and a couple of years thereafter, took the LSAT to get into law school, and three of us decided to leave and formed our own environmental consulting firm, which really went well for a year, but then we got hit by a recession and an energy crisis. So I decided to go to law because it made the most sense because it gave me lots of different avenues I could proceed.
You not only went to law school, I mean, you jumped in both feet, lock, stock, and barrel. In fact, to shorten your time in law school, you went year round, no breaks, graduated in the top 10% of your class, and I'm guessing could have pursued any avenue of law that you chose. Was it that your first opportunities to engage with the legal system came in a public defender capacity, or just what made you pursue trial law?
Well, when I was in law school, I happened to meet someone that I knew for years who was friends of my sister, and he became a lawyer, and I saw him after my first year, and he said, "You know, I can get you in potentially in the public defender's office and potentially a spot after you graduate." So I hooked up with him. I got into the public defender's office while I was in school and learned a lot, and things just worked out for me that after I graduated and took the bar, I got into the public defender's office, which at that time was a part-time job, so I could also pursue a private career. And I became a trial lawyer because I started trying cases and I loved being in the courtroom.
We're going to spend some time in the courtroom as we talk about your book, The Making of Darth Zahner. And you recount case after case. And many are cases I remember, and you will too, folks, when you read the book, because a lot of those made not only the local news in television, but made national waves and got him on places like Montel Williams and Dr. Phil. But there were very early and not very public cases at all, some small stuff that to me, as I read the book, showed how much doing your homework can affect the outcomes. I mean, here you are, a wet behind the ears young defender, You're in some county courtroom out there and discover that charges are being brought by affidavit when they're supposed to be brought by complaint. As a reader, I say, I don't know the difference, but it made a difference, and you got a bunch of charges dropped because the system wasn't functioning correctly. It seems to me, you always look at that as part of your job of keeping the system on its toes.
Well, the only way there's justice is everyone follows the rules, follows the law, and does what they're supposed to do. And part of it was, I did some research and saw that they were not supposed to be using these affidavits. They had to be by complaints. So I filed a motion to dismiss all of my charges for all the juveniles I was representing, which all got dismissed. They had probably about a 4.5 foot high pre-printed forms that they had to throw all of that out. So they certainly considered me a rabble-rouser in that court.
I think, as we're going to find out in this conversation, you didn't lose a lot of sleep over being dubbed a rabble-rouser in the court
Absolutely
system.
not.
Let's stay in those early years, because I found this really telling. Lauren Zaners, my guest, longtime Toledo attorney, defense attorney. You had a juvenile judge tell you that your job was to do was that whatever was in the best interest of your clients, even if that conflicted with their constitutional rights. And in the book, you say, you disagreed. In other words, the judge seemed to be saying, okay, the kid's a troublemaker. Let's get him in the system. Let's get him the help he needs. Let's get him fixed. Whereas you, Mr. Defense Attorney, are just trying to get him off, send him back on the streets. We don't fix anything. So walk me through that you disagreed with the judge telling you that it was in the best interest of your clients. That's what your job was to do.
Well, it's not necessarily in the best interest of my clients to do my job. But I have a constitutional and an ethical obligation to protect their constitutional rights. And if something is not done correctly, such as an illegal search, an illegal confession, then I have every obligation to raise those issues and try to get the charge dismissed or get the evidence suppressed. That's my job. And part of where I learned that, not only in law school, but I went to a seminar out at the Judicial Conference, National Judicial Conference in Reno, Nevada, and there were judges and prosecutors and probation officers and defense attorneys speaking, and every one of them says your obligation as a lawyer is to protect your client's constitutional rights. You don't get to their best interest until after it appears that doing everything you can to beat the charges or have the charges dismissed, if your client's going to be found guilty or responsible, then you look at what's in the best interest, not before.
You also write in your book that, well, let me suggest that I think all of us out here, we look to the courts to determine guilt or innocence. But you write that as a defense attorney, that's not really your job.
It's not my job to determine guilt or innocence. It's to protect my client's constitutional rights. It's up to the state to provide the evidence to try to prove your client guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It doesn't matter to me whether or not, really, if they did it or didn't do it. I'm going to protect my client's constitutional rights, and I'm going to do everything I can to try to get the best result for him or her. It's up to the state to prove it. It's not up to me to prove it.
I've always wondered, in all the years I've known you, I can't believe I haven't asked you. Or if I did, I have forgotten, which is also a possibility. We go back a few years. Did you flat out ask the people you were representing, did you do it?
Usually not, because it's not important. I want to know what the evidence that the state has. I'll review it with my client. If they've made statements, we'll talk about that. But if they haven't made statements, I don't necessarily want to know, because part of the problem is if a client tells me they're guilty. In fact, I had a client one time came into me and said, I'm guilty of this offense, but this is what I'm going to testify to, which means they're going to lie. And it's unethical for a lawyer to suborn perjury, to try to put perjured testimony on the stand. And I told the client, if you're going to testify that way, then I suggest you get another lawyer. And I ended up not representing the person. So I have more options by not finding out if they're guilty or not guilty at the beginning if I want to put the client on the stand. I don't know what the truth is. They only know what the truth is. So if they told me they did something else and then are going to lie about it, it's difficult. You can put somebody on the stand, but there's a lot of ethical requirements that you have to do with doing that.
I love some of the real life incidents that you recount. Folks, stay with me. Lauren Zaner brought a pound of bacon into court in a case of a defendant charged with stealing a pig. He used a twin, as in a lookalike sibling, a twin, and sat the twin next to him in court to appear as though it was the defendant when it wasn't the defendant, in an effort to get charges dropped. Some would say, and that's just making a mockery of the court system. What say you?
Well, there are some times I have to admit that I am a smart ass and I will do certain things. With the twin situation, I talked to the court outside the presence of the prosecutor and told the court I was going to do that. So it wasn't as if I was making a total mockery of the system.
Okay.
And so the court was aware what I did. The funny thing was that the officer absolutely could tell the difference between the two twins. So my client ended up being found guilty of the offense. And the bacon was just for fun. Because they didn't have any evidence. So I said, well, that's where the bacon is because my client was charged with stealing a pig.
Do this for me. Did you have, I'm just guessing, lawyers in and around Toledo, Northwest Ohio, and the state of Michigan? He's also licensed to practice there. I'm guessing they were scrambling to get this book to say, what's Lauren going to say about me in this book? Did you hear about that?
I've heard that from some people for sure, and from some judges, but for the most part, I don't specifically name people. There's some places I do, especially judges that are retired, but I don't mention names of clients for the most part because you have an ethical obligation not to do that kind of stuff.
You do write about some attorneys and name them. I remember in the news business, Terry Jones. I mean, he could turn on the courtroom theatrics, right? And
Absolutely.
you write about a time that you guys were on a case, and he told you at the end of the day, "Hey, you were more obnoxious in court today than I was," and you took that as a compliment.
Absolutely. I knew Terry. I knew him when he was in high school because he went to high school with my sister, who
At
was
Scott.
6 years older at Scott. And Terry was a really good lawyer and a good trial lawyer. He could do things most people couldn't do. But he was always being rambunctious in the things that he was doing. So it was kind of fun when we tried that case and he told me that later.
You take pride in the fact that you were aggressive because you were aggressive in the defense of your clients. I do want to talk to you now about some issues within court, and then I have a couple of cases. I want to talk about the importance of jury selection because it's not a perfect system. And from your very first jury trial, you learn that because you had a prospective juror that you thought that this guy's problems. He's going to be problems for me if he makes it, but there's only any so many challenges you guys get. This guy ends up being seated, and at the end of the day, ends up being the lone vote for acquittal. The jury hangs, your client gets off, and it was really the guy that you had suspected would probably be a problem. And I just wonder, I mean, there are all sorts of reservations about juries, but it's still what, the best way possible to determine guilt or innocence? Or what do we do with that?
You have a right to have a trial to the court, or you have a right to have a jury trial. And there are very few times that I have waived juries. There's some because judges are political. They get, elected to office. The press can go after them if they make bad decisions. Not saying they're trying to be dishonest, but it concerns me. Public pressure, I think, time to time will have effect on a judge. And with a judge, you only have one person to make a decision. With a jury, you have, in a felony, you have 12, and it only takes one person to hang it, like that DUI trial, which was an eight jury person. Picking a jury is critical. There's a lot of research about picking juries and stuff, but so much of it is gut feelings and how you feel about somebody. You have to really listen to what they say. You have to give them the opportunity to respond. You don't want to do yes or no questions. You want to give them open-ended questions so they can talk so you get a little feel for them. And then you try to go back and forth with the jurors. You know, Miss Smith, you heard what Mr. Jones had to say. What do you think about that? Do you have anything to add? So you want the jury talking so you can get a feel, is this going to be the right juror for you or not?
Let's get into some of your high-profile cases, and there are many of them. Lauren Zaner is my guest. I'm going to start with Floyd Fay. You know that, Buzz Fay, because as a Wood County guy, I covered that story down here. He was accused of killing a Perrysburg carryout owner, largely convicted on the victim's words. The gentleman who was shot and who would die, tragically, said the words, "Buzz did it," but then added his own little disclaimer as, "But it couldn't be." Buzz Fay, he knew Buzz Fay, and remembered these words are coming out of a man who is, I'm so sorry to say, mortally wounded, tremendous blood loss. In his eyewitness accounts, some of these words came out at the hospital where he had mercifully been administered painkillers because of his injuries, Demerol. Buzz Fay was convicted, ladies and gentlemen, based on that and the fact that he owned a shotgun, which was a murder weapon, but they couldn't link his specific murder weapon. And only because Ohio's death penalty was on hold at that time, Buzz Fay was convicted here in Wood County, could have been, would otherwise have been on death row, and could have been executed. And by the way, he didn't do it, ladies and gentlemen. Your longtime legal partner, Adrian Zimmerman, back then a public defender, helped find the person who did pull the trigger. And I tell you, that case alone, I've always been a person, capital punishment, I hate to see it used, but there are times for it. But the fact that I saw a case and we got to interview Buzz, would he, and he did the Phil Donahue show. He allowed me to interview him several times. And I got to think, this is some poor sap living out in a trailer out here. And I don't mean that mean. This is just a regular John Q. public guy who's, they came knocking at his doors, and the next thing you know, we could have put him to death. And I'm just wondering if, how that affected your view of the whole issue of capital punishment and your comments on that case.
Well, you know, Buzz and I remained friends after that case
I know.
through. I'm against capital punishment because you never know when you're going to put somebody who's really not guilty to death. Look at all the through the Innocence Project, all the people that are getting out of prison because they were wrongly convicted. But the interesting thing about Buzz's case was I received a phone call about a year after the conviction from a man who said he had information about the case and tried to contact the police and contact the prosecutor's office, but they wouldn't talk to him. So Adrian and I, who I knew Adrian really well because he was trained by one of my previous interns, went to Sandusky and met with this man. And what happened is the man's wife, the person who was actually guilty of the offense came and lived with them, and the guy a year later split with this guy's wife, and the guy got upset about it and came forward. So based on what he told Adrian and I pursued one avenue, Adrian pursued another, and Adrian was able to prove that Buzz was innocent and got all the charges dismissed against him. Buzz subsequently filed a lawsuit against everybody, but the one person he wouldn't include as a defendant was me. He wouldn't sue me. Buzz and I remained friends for years, until his passing away a year or two ago.
Lauren Zaner, you also carved out a niche defending people accused of sexual abuse. Now, stay with me, folks, because I know a lot of folks are saying, oh, those slugs, and he's only a step above those people if he's defending them. But you had several cases that proved that such allegations are so hard to disprove, but boy, they are great weapons in all sorts of domestic cases. Just the accusation implies guilt. But in one case that you point out, you prove the defendant was A, never alone with the alleged neighbor girl who was leveling the charges. It finally came out that he was taking his family and kids on a great vacation, and she was ticked that she wasn't invited and thought this is the way to get even. And so, for those of you who think that everybody who's ever charged with sexual abuse did it, a case like that gives pause.
Well, the scary thing to me is the police don't do a really good job of investigating. If an allegation is made, they kind of get tunnel vision and they just look at trying to support the allegation. They don't look at surrounding issues or surrounding facts, reasons why these allegations could be false, reasons why the child potentially could be making up these allegations. And that's one of the things that I certainly pursued. I would hire investigators to go and talk to potential witnesses and try to get information. And fortunately, I was very successful in handling those cases. In fact, there was one time my trial consultant told me that she was keeping track of it. I won like 12 or 16 cases in a row.
You ever lost sleep? Do you lose sleep over getting somebody off that you think they probably did it?
You know, I never lose sleep over that. I lose sleep over the ones where the person is found guilty and I'm convinced that they're not guilty. Those are the ones I lose sleep over. I'd rather have 100 guilty people walking the street than one innocent person in custody.
Shaken baby cases, again, so emotional because those are the most innocent of victims. But you recount cases in one I recently revisited, went back to your book, where a coroner's testimony that was so damning was actually proven to be untrue. And that, not to get into the weeds here, you can get into the book yourselves, folks. But a coroner says, no, there was blood, there was bleeding in the entire spinal cord, which would have supported one outcome. You found and hired experts who came in and, with the court's permission, examined tissue, if you will, to show that that was an incorrect statement. And but without that immense legwork and court-approved medical testing, somebody would have gone away for a very long time.
Yeah, absolutely, because the child passed away, unfortunately. And, you know, that was a case that I made no money on. I ended up spending $35,000 out of my pocket to obtain the best experts in the country. In fact, one of them, the prosecutor asked, it was Dr. Omaya, Dr. Omaya, I'm going to show you a CT scan. Are you familiar with it? He said, yeah, back in the 50s, so and so and I developed that whole process. So, I mean, those are the kind of people that I used, but that's what it took. I brought in the Cyril Weck from Pennsylvania, who was involved in investigating with the Kennedy assassination, and he went to the coroner's office and examined tissues and said, well, what the coroner said was not accurate, and we developed our defense, and fortunately the woman was found not guilty. And that's the case I got on Montel Williams about.
And again, in case you missed it, yeah, Mr. Zahner just said he spent thousands of his own dollars, which leads me to this question. Given the resources it does take to put on an adequate defense, can poor people get equal justice under law?
You know, it's interesting that you asked that, Jerry. I went to the Reverend Al Sharpton's place in Harlem, New York, and gave a speech about representing indigents. And public defenders and court-appointed attorneys can be every bit as good as a private attorney. The difference is the funds available to obtain experts, to obtain investigators, because the court doesn't have to give you the best expert. They can give you some money. But whereas a private attorney can do, if a client has lots of money, you can do so much more. And so the system is not fair. It's not perfect.
Did you ever entertain becoming a judge?
You know, I thought about it one time. I was upset that a judge wouldn't have let my clients, when there was a no contact order, and my client's parents wanted to give Christmas presents to the kids. And the court said no, and I thought that was just outrageous. So I was on vacation, I was walking the beach, planning my campaign and decided, I don't want to take the pay cut and I don't want to be a judge. I want to try to represent people.
All right, I've waited long enough. The Making of Darth Zaner. Explain the title, because I think it's a great one.
Well, actually, my wife was the one who came up with the title, but I had a case where I represented a Toledo police officer charged with sex trafficking, and obviously a very contentious trial. And we went to trial, and he was found not guilty of all charges. And one of the women who represents victims of sex trafficking came up to me and says, Lauren, we have a name for you. I said, yeah, what's that? She said, Darth Zaner. I loved it, and it just made sense to name the book that.
I'll play on Darth Vader, obviously. And where can people get this work, The Making of Darth Zaner?
Well, it's available from the publisher, which is Orange Fraser Press, which is in Wilmington, Ohio, or it's also on Amazon.
It is it's a great read, folks. And you think we touched on a lot today. There are so many more cases in there. A lot of them you're going to say, "Oh yeah, I remember that one. Oh yeah, I remember that was on TV." And he lived it, and he fought for the right ending, for the right verdict in cases. And I know that as defense attorneys, sometimes you guys take a bunch of heat. By the same token, I would just suggest, as I've taken this upon myself watching cases all these years, if I'm accused of something, and it's not going to be a crime because I'm not a criminal, but if I'm accused of something, I want a darn good defense attorney. And so they are a critically important part of the criminal justice system. Lauren Zaner, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Continued success in your post-trial life.
Thank you, Jerry. It's so good to see you and talk with you. I appreciate it.
Be well.
Take care.
Well, that's going to do it for us this week. I want to thank Tom Hostler, Lauren Zaner, and especially I want to thank you for joining us here on The Anderson Hour. I'm Jerry Anderson. Hope to talk to you soon, right here on The Local Thread.
The Local Thread is a production of WGTE Public Media. Episodes can be heard weeknights at 7 on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org.